This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow is our producer, and our leadoff guest is Tyler Bridges, the talented Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Advocate and Picayune, covering Louisiana politics. And we are 7 months away, as of today, from the primary for governor of Louisiana. So there is time for things to change, but there is an infinite amount of time. And as a result of that, we probably know who's in the race and who isn't at this point. And Tyler Bridges, the last week was certainly a harbinger of things to come. We got a glimpse, I think, of who will be on the ballot come October 14th.
Yeah, last week, Sean Williams, after talking about it,
Sean Wilson
time, actually got. I'm sorry. Yes, Sean Wilson got into the race. Sorry, and also Garrett Graves chose to not get in the race, and of course Stephen Wagspack, who'd been the longtime head of the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, got in the race. So now we have five Republicans, one Democrat, and one Independent, who I guess is going to be on your show following me.
That's the plan. We are slated to hear from Hunter Lundy, and he's a guy who's been around for a long time. And in the latest poll, for what it's worth, he got 3% of the votes, which isn't a lot, but that was fourth overall, tied with John Schroeder. But the poll, and I think this was a Cuvion poll, had Sean Wilson at 29%, Jeff Landry 28%. At that time, Garrett Graves was the flavor of the moment, and he was at 12, so that's probably around where Wagaspack would start. Lundy 3, Schroeder 3, Hewitt 2, and Nelson 1, and 22% undecided. But in politics, sometimes a week can be pivotal, and we have 30 weeks remaining between now and Election Day. And I would suspect much will happen between now and then. How do you see the race evolving, Tyler?
Yeah, I think this is the way I'm looking at it, Jim, which is to say that things can and they certainly will evolve. Remember, at this point, 8 years ago, David Vitter was still the heavy favorite in the race. Not many people gave John Bel Edwards a chance of winning. Scott Angell was just beginning to try to make a name for himself. And remember, Angell almost passed up Vitter to finish second and go into the runoff with Edwards, and he probably would have. Angell probably would have run the race. So I think the important thing is to keep an open mind as possible. Yeah, there are certain candidates who are very low in the polls right now. A lot of that is name recognition, and they certainly do need to find ways to become more popular, because by rising in the polls, you can get more campaign contributions and to spend more money to become better known. But as you well know, Jim, there's a history in Louisiana of surprises in governor's races, of twists and turns that we don't expect. I think most people would agree that at this point, Jeff Landry is the front runner, but there's been plenty of front runners in past gubernatorial elections who didn't end up winning the rights to live in the governor's mansion.
In retrospect, we could see why things didn't work for David Vitter, for example, and why things did work for Mike Foster, who came out of nowhere and won in 2003, but it's always easier in hindsight to see these things and looking forward. Now, on Friday's show, James Carville indicated that Jeff Landry has all but one spot locked up in the runoff. Now, there are others who would disagree. They would think Sean Wilson is probably the one, unless another Democrat gets in, who would be most likely to have a runoff spot locked up, and then it gets tough after that. But Landry yesterday got the endorsement, for what it's worth, from the Baton Rouge Republican Party, the party leadership in the largest parish in Louisiana. It's led by the organization's led by Woody Jenkins, but it's significant in that it's right in Stephen Wagaspack's backyard. His LABI office is right on Main Street. He's been here a long time, and Jeff Landry is the favorite of the Republican establishment, not only in New Orleans, but also in Baton Rouge. Is there anything that should be made of that?
Jim, I think there is. I would not put much emphasis on the fact that Wagaspack's office is in East Baton Rouge Parish. Wagaspack didn't even get a chance to compete for that endorsement. So But I think it's significant because I think this is another effort by the Landry campaign to show that they have momentum, that they are the front runner and they are the strong candidate. So particularly big donors who are the people, I think Landry particularly is interested in this point, that they ought to get aboard his campaign.
Jeremy Alford, who will be with us Friday, has noted that Wagasback has a PAC and that by virtue of that, people can contribute without revealing their names. And some people, according to Jeremy, who knows the terrain pretty well, might not want Jeff Landry to know they're also contributing to Stephen Wagasback. And he may be able to raise a lot of money. And I suspect he will raise a few million dollars. But Landry had a head start. And Wagasback has a lot of ground to make up. And he's never run for office before. Does that mean that he is dead on arrival, or does he have a real shot of getting momentum and becoming a real player in this race?
Yeah, Jim, the way I look at it is I try not to rule out any candidates. I sort of look at paths to victory, and certainly there is a path to victory for Stephen Wagasback. Certain things have to happen, just as there's a path to victory for all of the candidates. Some of the candidates have more paths to victory than others, but as you mentioned, since Wagasback has not run for office before, he is untested. He has been around government at the highest levels, having worked for Bobby Jindal, and obviously his work for Labie over the past decade has exposed him to the governor and the legislature repeatedly. So he may well have absorbed very good lessons, but we just don't know yet, and I think that will play out in the coming weeks and months.
Well, 4 years ago, eight years ago when we had Angel and Vitter and Darden and Edwards and Vitter. I think the only candidate in that race who had actually lost a race at that point was Darden, and it was his first race ever to Larry Bankston by 110 votes for the state Senate. But he'd won race after race after race for the Metro Council, for the State House, for Secretary of State, for Lieutenant Governor. Edwards was 2-0 in legislative races, and Vitter had never lost a race, and I don't believe Angel had ever been defeated. This time around, we have Jeff Landry, who is the favorite. He's 3-2. He's won three. He's lost two. Sean Wilson is 0-1. He ran for the Lafayette Council in 2008 and was defeated. And Wagasback is 0-0, and they are considered the three front runners right now. It is curious that we don't have the all-star cast that we've had in the past of people running for governor, Tyler.
Yeah, there's nobody in Congress running as we did 4 years ago with Ralph Abraham, certainly, and then 8 years ago with Vitter, and then going back to Bobby Jindal, he was a congressman when he ran. I guess it could be looked at various ways. But actually, Jim, I thought it was interesting, your analysis of past records. I guess I don't think Sharon Hewitt's 2-0, right? And John Schroeder is, what, maybe 4 or 5-0 as well? And well, Hunter Lundy is 0-1, I think.
And Richard Nelson is undefeated. So it's the lower-tier candidates who have better records of winning winning elections, rather. And a listener, this is Taylor, not Tyler, but Taylor on Government Street says, do you think all the Republicans will stay in, or will some of them start dropping off with the poll numbers right now showing not much traction for those candidates that we just mentioned?
Yeah, there's two questions. One is, can they rise in the polls? Because you have to rise in the polls to be seen as electable, to be able to get media attention and campaign contributions. The other is, what is the stomach of the candidate? John Schroeder has said that it's up or it's out. In other words, he's staying in this race no matter what. He does not want to run for treasurer. But it's also worth remembering, as you know, Jim, that qualifying is not until August 8 till 10. And so candidates literally have until that time to make their final decision.
At 5 months. And that always elicits rumors that somebody else might get in. But as you know, that's easier said than done. Somebody who would do it at this stage would have to have significant resources, namely money. Is there anyone in the offing who would fit that description?
I can't think of anybody who could fit that. On the Democratic side, clearly Gary Chambers could potentially get in the race as the leading Democratic vote getter in last year's Senate election, but he has told me on three separate occasions, he is not getting the race, and he is supporting Sean Wilson. On who else might be on the Republican side? I just can't think of a big name who could get in the race and have an impact.
Well, there's John Georges, who could run and would be a factor.
The owner of my newspaper, yeah. None of us want to see that.
Mitch Landrieu could run.
Yeah, that's not. You know, he's got a much bigger job.
I don't think he is going to. But those are the kinds of people who would be able to get in and make a splash almost immediately. But the chances of that happening appear to be unlikely. But there is this aversion in the country club ranks to Jeff Landrieu, and he definitely in this race will be the blue collar Republican. And I don't mean this disparagingly, but Stephen Wagespack is the silk stocking Republican in the race, and we'll talk with Tyler Bridges about that dynamic after this. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you as part of the audience on Talk Louisiana. And if you'd like to join the conversation, your number is 877-217-5757. It's always a pleasure to catch up with Tyler Bridges, who will be covering the Louisiana governor's election. He's been covering him going back to 1991 when we had the race from hell. We had Edwin Edwards and David Duke and Buddy Romer, Clyde Holloway, Sam Jones, Fred Dent, Ed Karst, a lot of big names in that race. Not as many as there were in 1987 when we had three congressmen, not one, not two, but three all running at the same time, and all three were 43 years old at the time. Bob Livingston, Buddy Romer, Billy Tozan. We had the Secretary of State running, Jim Brown. We had Governor Edwards running for re-election. We had former Congressman Speedy Long for a while. There was Fox McKithen in that race. There was Butch Baum. That was really the race as far as the most prominent politicos. And this time, some would say this is the B team. It's reminiscent of 2007 when Bobby Jindal had not won a race other than his victory in Congress after being defeated in the 2003 governor's election. And his opponents were Foster Campbell and also Walter Blasso and John Georges. And Jindal won without a runoff. And that's another question from a listener. This one is Tracy at the Capitol saying, is it possible somebody could win this race without a runoff? I don't see that as a possibility, but Tyler, what do you think?
Well, again, trying to keep an open mind, Jim, anything is possible, but I think the odds are exceedingly small. I think if no other Democrat gets in the race, the likely scenario is that Sean Wilson will run first in the primary with maybe 35%. 40% if he does really, really well. But it's hard to see a scenario under which anybody could win the primary outright.
And in Louisiana, with our open primary, which may very well be, it may change if there is a Republican governor, but the breakout, as you know, Tyler, right now in a mock race would be 60% Republican, 40% Democratic. But let's say, for example, we had five candidates like we did in 1987. And they were all of equal stature, and they were all running about equal moving into the primary, which would be unusual. But potentially there could be a weird scenario in which two Democrats in a Republican state could make a runoff because of the way the math would break out. If you've got more Republicans running than Democrats, for example, you said Sean Wilson might get 40. Well, let's say another Democrat got in and got 20 and Wilson got 20. Well, with a field as crowded as it is on the Republican side, potentially you could have two Democrats in a runoff for governor in a Republican state. Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, I got to discount that possibility because I really don't think they're going to see a major Democrat get in the race. Again, the more likely scenario is that Sean Wilson would run first with maybe about 35%, and then the battle would be for second place among the Republicans, maybe 20%, 22%, 23%. But as I said earlier, we just don't know because things change and things unexpectedly happen mm-hmm. in Louisiana governor's races. And you know that so well, Jim.
Oh, yeah. And a listener, this is Hal in Monroe, has noted, what would happen if Foster Campbell got in? Now, here's a guy who I think on his worst day would get 10%, and it probably would come right off Sean Wilson. That could change the dynamics and something like that. And I think Foster would actually get more than that in this field. But hypothetically, we could still end up with two Republicans in the race. And that probably is what, in the runoff, that's probably what Wagisback is counting on. I think he believes that if he gets in a runoff with Jeff Landry, he will get the lion's share of the Democratic vote. But he has been head of LABI. He did fight strenuously and effectively to keep the minimum wage at $7.25. Right now, it's at $11 in Arkansas. And yet, if he were to win, he's got to get a lot of Democratic vote and probably believes he can against Jeff Landry. But Landry's resume is such, Tyler, that he's been a cop. He's been he's been in the military. He's been a farmer. He has more of a, quote, blue-collar background than any of the other Republicans do. Your thoughts?
Well, clearly, Jeff Landry is running in the Trump lane, the Donald Trump lane. We expect Landry to formally get the former president's endorsement next month. And clearly, Wagisback is the business-oriented candidate. And, of course, Schroeder, Hewitt, and Nelson are trying to make themselves emerge as sort of the Republican alternative to Landry. And then again, your next guest, Hunter Lundy, is saying, hey, what about me? I'm a political independent. I'm both a trial lawyer, which might appeal to some people on the left. He's a Christian fundamentalist, which might appeal to some people on the right. So, hey, there's a scenario under which he could emerge potentially.
Well, he will be with us in just a moment. And Tyler, you're keeping your mind open, as you should, as a good reporter. And there will be surprises, but whether there are enough surprises to change the inertia, I don't know. And of course, there will be embarrassing revelations for any of the candidates who get traction. That's the nature of the beast. And as we look to October, I would imagine everything in the closet of Jeff Landry, Stephen Wagisback, whatever's in there, we'll know about it.
Yeah, I'm sure the opposition researchers are busy at work compiling their dossiers on all of the candidates.
And Sean Wilson, he may get a pass until the runoff. I think the Republicans, and this is a dangerous strategy, but they probably think they can beat him in a runoff, so leave him alone in the primary and hope he makes the runoff. But that, as I state, could be a dangerous scenario because he'll be running, if he is in a runoff, against a Republican who's not as strong as some of the other Republicans who have been in runoffs for governor. I think at this point, and based on the large Republican field, whoever makes the cut is likely to be a wounded warrior, Tyler.
Well, that's what happened in 2015, as you remember, particularly Scott Angel carved up David Vitter with his prostitution issue. And so Vitter limped into the runoff against John Bel Edwards. And then 4 years ago, Eddie Rasponi very severely and probably unfairly attacked Ralph Abraham, and Abraham never forgave him and that hurt Rasponi in the runoff against John Bel Edwards.
And even at that, Rasponi only lost by 40,000 votes.
Yeah, and you know, talking about first-time candidates, Eddie Rasponi was strong enough as a first-time candidate to get into the runoff, and as you said, he was almost elected governor.
Well, we thank you, Tyler. It's always a pleasure, and we'll be calling again soon. Thank you. Good to visit with you.
Thank you.
And we're joined now by Hunter Lundy, who many years ago ran, I think it was it 96? He ran a close race. He almost upset Chris John, who was the establishment candidate for the congressional seat, the old 7th District. And Hunter Lundy has stayed in his home turf at Southwest Louisiana. He's one of the most prominent lawyers in that area, a trial lawyer. And he's also made no secret of the fact that he is an evangelical Christian. So some would say he's not at home at either party, and there he is running as an independent. Now, are you running Hunter Lundy as a member of the Independent Party, which is now an official party in Louisiana, or just as an independent?
I'm running as an independent, Jim. That's how I registered when I changed parties a number of years back. Didn't really give it a lot of thought. I just knew I wasn't going to register as a Republican, and I was going to leave the Democratic Party. So I just registered. So whether you want to call me an independent with a little I, a big I, whether you want to call me another party, I don't care. I just consider the people of Louisiana as my party, and I'm just not into the red and the blue politics that seem to be going on that are running as that.
You don't seem to be at home in either party, though, because your positions on social issues are not in line with the National Democratic Party, and your positions on economic issues are not in line with the National Republican Party. So are you comfortable where you are, and can you win as an independent?
Well, you know, there's 863,000 registered independent and other voters in Louisiana. And we've seen the Democratic Party go from about 1.7 million to 1.2 in the last decade. We've seen a larger increase in independents than in any other party. The Republicans have increased some. But, you know, I am a fiscally conservative person. So, you know, a lot of people in the Republican Party align with me. A lot of people in the faith community align up with me.
We'll return after this with more from Hunter Lundy. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Hunter Lundy is with us, candidate for governor. Prominent lawyer in Lake Charles. He is extremely well known there. And a listener asked about the race I mentioned, 1996, when he lost a tough one to Chris John, and asked who John succeeded. It was Jimmy Hayes. And Jimmy Hayes that year ran for the U.S. Senate. In the race that was won by 5,788 votes by Mary Landrieu over Woody Jenkins. Hunter Lundy, yesterday, the Republican Party, led by Mr. Jenkins in Baton Rouge, endorsed Jeff Landry. And on social issues, I would think that the two of you are close, but you tell me if there's a distinction between you and Jeff Landry on social issues that are, of course, prominent in Louisiana.
I don't know what distinctions could be drawn. Jeff has done some things that I've agreed with, and that he's fought against the mandates and the things that he attacked. I would have done that had I been the attorney general. Of course, I would have showed up at a parole hearing for a triple homicide murderer that was paroled when he did a no-show on a guy that was convicted in Southwest Louisiana, and so the dadgum district attorney in Calcasieu Parish had to go get it rescinded. So I think that the distinction has to do with fulfilling duties and being there, not using a political office to campaign with. But other than that, on social issues, I think we're aligned on a lot of social issues. The difference is I'm a consensus builder. I'm not a grenade thrower. And so as a governor, you have to be a consensus builder unless you have to draw the line. And of course, I will fight. I mean, I'm known for my reputation as being a tenacious lawyer, and so I will stand and fight on the things that I know are principle related. So the differences are, I guess mechanisms of behavior would be the best analogy. The difference between me and Jeff, but yeah, we're aligned on many of the social issues, and but that's it. You know, you asked me earlier about electability. You know, I'm going to remind the constituents of Governor Blanco. She made the runoff with 18% in the primary, and she became the governor. And so what I'm watching today that's going on between the Democrats and the Republicans, I know what number I need to make the runoff. And as the independent, if I make the runoff, I'm your governor. So that's the intelligence behind our campaign and the people that we've hired and the efforts that we're making. And I kind of do feel like Johnny Cash. I'm everywhere, and I've been everywhere, and I will continue doing that, Jim. But any other? I mean, I'll answer any question that
all
you
right.
have.
All right. Well, we'll go to the phones as well. But if you were to get traction, you might very well make a runoff with 18% of the votes. So you're talking about getting about 1 out of 5 votes to make the second round, and you've lent yourself a sizable amount of money, so you have resources. But we saw Eddie Rasponi lend himself $13 million last time, and he still lost. That's always tough when you're self-financing, Hunter.
Well, I'm not self-financing. In the first reporting period, I raised the most money next to the attorney general. So I raised more money than any of the Republican candidates. And so I will continue, and I'm continuing to raise money. As you know, when you run a statewide race, you can't quit raising money. So, yes, I saw the Republicans and Responi spend millions of dollars and lose. And so at the same time, I saw John Kennedy win the U.S. Senate in 2016 and spend $3 million to win it. And so I understand that timing is everything. Hard work is important. Having the right message. And I'm the guy that's willing to talk about poverty when nobody else will talk about it. And I think, you know, if we're gonna change the makeup of the state, if we're gonna revitalize the state, we have to cure that issue right up front. And so there's a way to do that. You know, I grew up in a household where my mother would say cleanliness is next to godliness. And so we have to get rid of blight in Louisiana. We're getting new jobs. I mean, I saw the report today that there's increase in new jobs and decrease in unemployment in New Orleans and Baton Rouge and a few places. But, I mean, if we're going to fix the state, we've got to go right to the heart of the problem. And so as long as we're at the top of the nation's list as having the most poverty, we will always have a negative review. And I'm not for that. I'm about excellence. We need to be compared to states in Northeast and the Midwest and Northwest, and we don't need to be comparing ourselves to other states in the South. We need to be better because we have better resources, better people, and, you know, education. You know, the one thing that's revealed to me is that we can do this thing through education. We can stop recidivism in our jails. We can make Angola our biggest college. We can do a lot of different things that will help. We can reach out, and I've seen some things recently by the legislature, and putting more money towards our childhood education. We have.
All right. You're on a roll, and we do have to get some calls, and I have some inquiries online as well at talklouisiana.org for Hunter Lundy. And one of them is, it's not really a secret, but your political consultant is a guy well known in these parts, the brother of John Kennedy. George Kennedy is handling your campaign, correct?
Well, he's handling the media in the campaign, and he is, very creative and very talented, and I'm blessed to have him. Press Robinson is the campaign manager. He was the chief of staff for John Kennedy, and he was the managed John Kennedy's campaign in 2016.
He's a good man, but and I think Kennedy did dismiss him, which was a bizarre move, but he did it. But yeah, I hear nothing but good things about Press Robinson. Sadie in Westlake. Sadie, you're on with Hunter Lundy. Hi, Sadie.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning, Sadie.
Good morning. I'm also an independent and feel like party politics is the heart of the problem in our entire nation, and especially here in Louisiana. And I agree that Louisiana, it's time for us to step up as a state and set ourselves apart from other states in the South. One of the things that I am the most concerned about, and I actually am one of the founding members of a group here in Southwest Louisiana called Pro-Choice with Heart, because we are very concerned about the principle of women having the right to body autonomy and our bodies being legislated and being told what we can and cannot do with our bodies.
All right. That's an issue I know you've been questioned about a few times, Hunter Lundy. You are staunchly, quote, pro-life, but does Sadie have a point that you can be pro-life and just not be in favor of telling somebody else whether they can or can't have an abortion? Your thoughts?
Well, I'm against, government funding any money for abortions. I'm against abortion. I've made that clear. I look at the big picture. Life is, you know, God created life, and we don't have a right to pass laws to take it away. And so I will always be pro-life. I'll always be conservative. And, I disagree with the issue of autonomy of the body. We've seen this thing go to an extreme. We've seen movements around the country where people are mutilating their bodies, and so I've experienced it, and I'm concerned about the women who go through abortions. 70% of them have mental illness later in life.
Now, how do you know that?
I don't think anybody wants
to talk about it. How do you know that?
I've read the studies. I've read the statistics.
Well, that doesn't mean they're right. That probably, based on just sheer numbers, about 40% of American women have had an abortion. And you're saying 70% of that 40%, which would mean 28% of the entire country has mental problems? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. I'm not of the country of women who've had abortions.
Well, that would be 28% of the entire country, because 40% of the women have had an abortion. And if 70% of them have mental problems related to that abortion, that means 28% of the country, women, have mental problems.
If your math is right, then that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm saying that is a problem.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, good morning. You're on with Hunter Lundy.
Thank you so much. I had the pleasure of meeting Hunter yesterday at lunch, and I was very impressed with his genuineness, his sincerity, and his real devotion to lifting Louisiana, especially in terms of education. And I certainly wish him good luck. It's the first time I had a personal meeting with a gubernatorial candidate.
Well, this guy, Hunter Lundy, I guess the question is also, why are you doing this? I know you've been extremely successful in your life, and you're 68 years old, and why are you trying to do this?
Well, Jim, my call in life has always been to help people, and I just consider it a different season in my life, and I have the ability, and I have relationships throughout the state of Louisiana. I've made them throughout the country, and I've actually made them throughout the world over the last 20 years of my life. And so I think, God's given me the wisdom to know that education is the most important thing if we're going to change Louisiana. And so I don't have time to give a message on education, but I promise you, we got 800,000 single parents in Louisiana, and most of them are women that are having to raise children. They need education so they can compete. Otherwise, they're having a tough time in life, and these kids end up on the street. When the kids end up on the street, they end up getting in trouble. So it just transcends all the way into our prison system. It transcends into the truancy. We've seen the articles on how many thousands of people are missing in Louisiana, young people in education. So I think that I have a plan that we can transform the state with. And it's education. We can get rid of the blight. We can increase our trade schools. 80% of the jobs.
All right, hold your fire. We would like to finish up with you and get a final note from Hunter Lundy, and we'll do that. Your number is 877-217-5757. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. On deck is a remarkable writer with a great story, Kate Zernike, winner of the Pulitzer Prize in explanatory reporting, but we're finishing it up with Hunter Lundy, and you can imagine anytime we get on these sensitive social issues, the lines start popping, and first in line was James and Metairie, so we'll take one call, and please be concise, James. You're on with Hunter Lundy.
Well, thank you, Jim, and good morning. Good morning to your guest. Sir, you're going to have quite a problem in winning this race when you're saying that 70% of the women have mental problems in the state of Louisiana.
Well, you said 70% of those had an abortion. That's what you said.
70% of those had an abortion. I stand corrected. You're still going to have problems with that kind of irresponsible statement. But let me ask you this. It seems as if the new conservative boogeyman is something called wokeism. The House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer, I think it was yesterday, blamed the bank failure out in Silicon Valley on wokeism. If elected, is wokeism going to be a place to die in Louisiana?
That's what Ron DeSantis says in Florida, but are you into that as well?
I'm not paying any attention to cliches that are being used on the national political level at all. So you're not looking at me using any kind of cliche to say what we're going to do or not do in Louisiana. What we're going to do is help the Louisiana people. We're going to reduce the unemployment level. We're going to increase the employment level. We're going to help resolve this blight issue that we have in the state as being the number one poverty issue. So I have plans for the economy. I have plans for the infrastructure. I have a plan for the education so that we can better the state, because I love the people of Louisiana. I love the state. So I'm not getting caught up in all of this this national political agenda, right?
Well, we do have to roll, but Hunter Lundy, best of luck to you, and we hope to have a visit with you in studio before the election of October 14th, 7 months from today. He's one of six candidates, I believe, who are in the field right now. Thank you, sir. Kate Zernike is with us. It's a pleasure. Nice to talk with you. It's been a few years. It's been a pleasure. Kate Zernike, reporter for the New York Times since 2000, a member of the team that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for stories about Al-Qaeda before and after the 9/11 terror attacks. And her latest work is The Exceptions, Nancy Hopkins, MIT, and the Fight for Women in Science. And it is a book that's overdue. And quite often, as we know in this world, and particularly in an area like science, women get less than their credit for what they have done. And it's good to hear your voice, Kate Zernike.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about Nancy Hopkins, an amazing story.
I met Nancy Hopkins in 1999 when I was a reporter at the Boston Globe, and I had gotten a tip that women at MIT were doing something around discrimination, and I thought, oh, 1999, you know, how bad can it be? And I met Nancy, and she told me that she and her female colleagues at the Institute had done a study looking at the ways that women were disadvantaged against men in many different ways. Salary, lab space, et cetera. And MIT, they had pulled their works together so convincingly that MIT actually acknowledged that it discriminated against its female scientists. And this news, which I broke on the front page of the Boston Globe that year, this news rippled out across science, and it was really incredible to see the number of women on other campuses who said, this is my story too. So the book, you know, at the time I didn't know much about Nancy Hopkins. I reported the story and kind of moved on, did a couple more stories about them over the years. But the book takes us back to 1963 when Nancy falls in love with science in a one-hour biology lecture. She's a student at Radcliffe, which is the girls' version of Harvard. And she falls in love with the idea of studying DNA at the very start of the genetics revolution in a lecture taught by James Watson 4 months after he and Francis Crick have won the Nobel Prize for decoding the structure of DNA. And it takes, she's not an activist and she's not a feminist. And so the book really traces her evolution as she gradually realizes that science is not a meritocracy, and that first she sees other women being discriminated against, and then she realizes that she's being discriminated against, and it drives her to do this work.
Well, she was a reluctant feminist, shall we say.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I think she really ran from it. She thought, like, those women are crazy. You know, they don't have anything to offer me. And she also thought that science was this real meritocracy, that it was all about data and numbers, and that that's all that mattered. It wouldn't matter whether you're a man or a woman.
Well, studies, for example, have shown that women actually do better in math than men. But the perception for years is that men are superior in that area. And we have these obstacles to get past, which are part of the fabric of our culture. Nancy Hopkins faced that. And this is a demanding area of work as well. So how did she survive?
She really survived like the other women did, by kind of keeping her head down and doing the work. And it's sort of it's the heartbreak of the story in some way. I mean, it's the triumph and the heartbreak, really. She thought science was a meritocracy. These women all thought, she eventually joins together with 15 other women, but they all thought that science was a meritocracy. They thought they were very lucky to have these jobs. And frankly, in the 1970s, when they got the jobs, they were lucky as women to get science jobs. But I think they kept their heads down and thought, like, they just were driven by the passion for the science. So when the story broke in 1999, they still didn't want to be known as activists. They really wanted to be celebrated for their science, which is what I've tried to do in this book, is sort of show people just the thrill of science and how it kept them going.
And the author is Kate Zernike. The book, The Exceptions, Nancy Hopkins, MIT, and the Fight for Women in Science. And this is your story. You've been on this for 25 years, haven't you?
Yeah, and you know, I was really inspired in the beginning by my father was a scientist, and he had told me about the lack of women in physics, which was his field, But I was also inspired by the story of my mom, who had graduated from college and wanted to go to law school and was told by her father's friends, you know, no woman will ever get a job as a lawyer. She ultimately did go to law school after her three kids were sort of in school and on their way. But it was very hard for women then. And I think these women educated me in 1999. I thought, based on my mother's experience and my own experience, I thought, okay, the doors are open now. That solved the problem. And what these women showed us was that it's not just about opening doors. It's really how you treat people, treat women and other underrepresented people as they go through their careers. You have to make sure that you're still giving them equal opportunity all the way through.
You write that when a few women came together after decades of underpayment and the denial of credit, advancement, equal resources to do their work, only then did we recognize the relentless pattern that women were often marginalized and minimized, especially as they grew older. Meanwhile, men of similar or lesser ability had their career paths paved and widened. It's hard to undo the past, but how much residue is there of this system that was in place for so long?
Well, it's interesting. You know, you look at MIT now, and it's essentially run by women. So there's a female board chair, a female president, a female dean of science, the School of Engineering, which has always been a very male enterprise. There are 8 departments, and 5 are led by women. That said, when you look at the number, when you look at PhD students and their attrition rate, you know, how many are dropping out of the field, there is a higher proportion of women. And I think when you talk to those women, what they will say is that old attitudes persist. So there really is this attitude still that girls just can't do math and science. As you point out, that's not backed up by the research. But I think there's really sort of, unfortunately, a sense for young women at MIT, they feel that change can't come fast enough. They recognize that there's change in the leadership, but they say they still are subject to these attitudes. And I think in some ways science is a really great, you know, I think the book will resonate with women in many different fields, but I think the reason that science is so tough is that it really does put a spotlight on intellectual, you know, our sense of women's intellectual abilities. We have the sense that, like, it requires genius to do science, and we still are more likely to see men instead of women as geniuses.
You've been a reporter for a while, but you started at such an early age, you're probably not halfway to the finish line in your career, Kate. But as you know, today, when somebody dislikes a story, it's branded as fake news. That's just a way to get rid of it, fake news. Well, in this case, when you point out something like this that is legitimate, there are those who say this is just part of the woke culture. How do you get past that?
I think that's true. And even at the time, people said this is junk science. So one response was to point out that there was a couple of Nobel Prize winners on the committee that found this, men and male Nobel Prize winners. And I don't think those men are going to engage in junk science. I think also when you see the pattern, and this is really what made the difference for the men at MIT and convinced them, when you see the pattern, it is just so overwhelming. I think the problem with or the reason wokeism upsets people is they feel like they are being told they're doing something wrong, or they are being told they're going to have to lose something. We have to stop seeing this as a zero-sum game. And I think the MIT story is really important because MIT was a place where everyone thought they were doing the right thing. These were people acting with the best of intentions, which I think is true for, I like to believe it's true for most of us. And so I think that often we have to recognize that even with the best of intentions, we all make missteps sometimes.
There are some great photos, and one is of Nancy, the only female scientist at a dinner table in 1979 at the Cold Spring Harbor Symposium. And there are a number of men at that table, and there's Nancy, and she's holding her own.
Yeah, and around that table, I believe it's 5 either existing or current or future Nobel Prize winners in that photo. So it's really something. And she really did think she was holding her own. It was upsetting to her. It was upsetting to her to realize that she had, you know, that she was being paid less, that she did have less lab space. It's humiliating to have to admit this.
Well, she is a fascinating character, and encourage everybody to read it, and there are aspects of this story, including a sexual assault, that are compelling and interesting. She's led a full life, most of it great, but of course, like most of us, she's had her issues as well. So we thank you so much for joining us and telling this story, and you can read about it in The Exceptions from Kate Czernicke. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Until tomorrow, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay safe and stay tuned.